Hi, McCartney fans, and welcome to episode 118 of Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast. We are a Paul McCartney talk show mainly dealing with the solo career of Paul McCartney. I'm one of your two co-hosts, Tom Hunyadi. You may know me from my other show, Talk More Talk, a solo Beatles video cast, and I am joined by my partner in crime, my backwards traveler, if you will, Andy Nichols. Andy, what's going on?
Surviving a snowstorm or lack thereof here in the East Coast on a snow day here in New Jersey.
fine.
Doing good. And,
yeah. Okay, cool. So you ended up going into work though, huh?
I did. I taught from an empty classroom and that was fine. So
okay. the life of COVID, huh? Just
nonstop.
Changing everything.
Yep.
Yeah. So, but as you can see, we have a special guest with us today and very excited to be talking with him today. He is a recording musician, Gabe Dixon. You're going to know him from his Gabe Dixon band. You know him from his solo career, Dave Dixon. And you also know him from being the keyboardist from the album Driving Rain. So, Gabe, thank you for being here. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm really good too. I'm really excited to be talking to you because this is an era that really doesn't get, you know, talked about that much with McCartney, and just a lot of questions for you. But first, we're just going to dig into your early, you know, your early career and talk about that. But first, have you listened to the new album, McCartney 3, actually?
I have listened to it. Yeah.
What was your impressions? Couple of times.
Yeah. My impressions are, I mean, it's kind of amazing. I have to say, like, just the sheer amount of stuff in there, like the amount of like production and little like tasty bits and motifs and everything he's got going on throughout the record. And the fact that it's pretty much all him. I mean, and I got to say, though, my favorite track is the very last one.
Yes. When Winter Comes.
Yes.
Yeah.
I listened through the whole record. I was like, this is pretty great. And that one came on and it was just magic. It was just like, this is magic. This is what's magical about Paul right here.
Right.
I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's what he did on that track, but it was just like, he saved the best for last.
It was the oldest one, you know? So,
oh yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't a new song.
It goes
back to like the early 90s.
Right.
I was going to say his voice had a different quality to it.
Exactly.
There you go.
Yes.
There you go. That's why.
Is that the only song like that on the record?
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, are you familiar with the song Calico Sky and Great Day?
I've heard it. Yeah.
Okay. But that was recorded right around the same time with George Martin as well. Yeah, so that's why the voice is completely it's Paul, it's the Paul that we're used to, really, his singing voice on that album. So but cool. Great. Glad you enjoyed it, because I mean, there's some really good, I mean, there's a lot of layers in some of those songs, and his guitar playing was just fantastic throughout the whole album.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. Like, I was just blown away at just his musicianship and his like his arranging sense, you know, the thing. Cause I mean, I experienced the sort of that the record I played on was sort of like a band.
Yes.
Sort of put it together as a band, but to hear him, and I know he's done this on other albums of
albums,
but like just to hear the latest iteration of it was, it reminded me just how talented he is.
Right.
Cool. Yeah. So it's good. It's as Tom mentioned, it's going to be a nice chat because the album you played on really kind of kicks off at the beginning of a kind of rebirth for McCartney. And he's released so many records in the 20 years since that the one that you played on kind of gets overlooked now with everything that he's done. So it's going to be really interesting to hear about how that came about and putting it together because it was the genesis of a new band that you were there for. And here we are now 20 years later and those guys are still with him.
Yep. It's true. Yeah.
So, but let's just talk about you to start with. Let's talk about some early influences of yours. And have you, were you born into playing piano? Did you start at an early age?
I picked it up really early. You know, just as soon as I could reach the keys, I was trying to play and started taking lessons, you know, seven and did the classical thing. And I think about 11 or so, 10 or 11, I really started getting into the Beatles and Elton John and a lot of stuff that was in my parents' record collection, you know, just going through it and the Paul Solo stuff, you know, and, you know, I just kind of started playing like, and being from Tennessee, I was big into Jerry Lee Lewis and stuff like
cool.
that. So I just like wanted to play rock and pop piano music, you know? And the second song I learned how to play on piano was Hey Jude. That was sort of one of the first ones where I was like, I really like this, you know, I feel at home kind of doing this. And so that was kind of how I got started, studied classical music all through till I graduated college, you know, but when I was about 12, I kind of joined this band, that was sort of like a teen band.
Okay.
I grew up in Nashville. And so there was a lot of, especially back then, it was a lot of country music.
Yeah.
And so this ended up being kind of like a teen country band.
Okay. Gotcha. Which
was, so I didn't really care that much about the country part. I just kind of, it was an outlet for me to play and like be in the studio and that sort of thing.
Right. So, I mean, were you kind of like in the minority in that sense? You know, because I mean, going to Nashville, I mean, that's like, you know, again, country city, I would imagine. But you know, getting more into the Beatles and Elton John, like you said, was that what kind of, you think you were in the minority there?
I don't know about the minority. I mean, Nashville's always had this sort of facade of, you know, the music industry in Nashville for a long time was country music mostly. But even back then in the early 90s, I was sort of, you know, I knew I was in other circles besides that, you know. I would go see like Bela Fleck and the Flecktones and you know, like Edgar Meyer played, he taught double bass at Blair School of Music where I went to study music. And you know, we'd have some people called it the great credibility scare of the early 90s, where they had jazz and blues, a lot of blues and stuff in Nashville. So that was more what I was into, you know, at the time. But I wouldn't say I was in the minority, but just because I don't even know, I was so young. I was just listening to whatever my parents were listening to, you know?
Yeah. I dig it when I hear people talk about rating their parents, you know, record or CD collections. You know, I think that's, you know, and then we end up, you know, appreciating the music. You know, my father was a huge Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes fan, and I just became a fan, you know, of theirs because of that. You know, all that Philly soul from the 70s, you know, was basically because of his fandom for it, you know. So, I tell you, I'm really impressed by your singing. I think you're a wonderful singer. Is that something that came to you early as well? Or
I just always sang in, you know, church choir and that kind of thing. But I never was a trained singer or anything. I just kind of, I wanted to sing. So I started singing, you know, and that was kind of how that happened. And I was really insecure about my singing for a long time until really like my late 20s. And I started to feel like, oh, you know what? I'm maybe not so bad.
No, I don't think you are, not at all.
But I just stumbled into it.
Gotcha. Talk about forming the Gabe Dixon band. How did that?
I was in school at University of Miami in college, and I had spent it was my junior year, and I had spent the previous summer playing in the back room of Tootsie's Orchid Lounge in Nashville, which is like a country bar downtown. But I was just playing. Okay. My grandfather used to hang out all the time down there. So he got me a gig playing for tips in the back room. from like, you know, Monday through Thursday from like 1 till 4 in the afternoon.
Okay. And I was going to say not in the morning.
No, no. That was another shift. They did have the 10 to 2 shift, but, so I had to put together, learn a bunch of covers, and I had written a handful of songs and stuff. So that was like my woodshed kind of play. I've just got to play a lot, just solo, you know, no band or anything. So when I got back to school, I thought I kind of missed it. So I thought I'll book a show on campus.
Gotcha.
And I booked one, and my roommates, John O'Ricks and Winston Harrison, they asked if I wanted a bass player and a drummer. And so, and then a couple other guys joined in, and we had our first gig.
Gotcha. So talk about that when you're playing and you're doing an original cover as opposed to, you know, songs that people love, and then you just whip out this new song that you just wrote or something like that. I mean, how does that go over?
You know, if I play it really well and it's a decent song, it usually goes over well. But early on, I'd only written like maybe 5 songs at that point. Mm-hmm. So I kind of wanted to keep the covers going because I wanted the people to stay in there, you know, and tip, you know what I mean?
Exactly. Right.
A lot of times I'd pull out one of my own songs if there was maybe 1 or 2 people in there, you know.
Gotcha.
Like, okay. All right, I'll just try this one out.
Right. So if it was a crowded night, obviously you want to probably keep to the hits and whatever.
Sometimes it'd be really crowded and I'd be playing a bunch of stuff that people knew, and then I'd just throw one in even though it was a big crowd. And then I'd go right into another cover, you know, just to kind of like
to taste it and see if they would go for it.
Like a little testing, you know, kind of see how that's been so much of what has helped me as a writer and performer is just trying that stuff out and seeing how the crowd reacts, you know.
Gotcha.
So you said you're a big Elton fan, so I'm guessing like all Elton, early Elton, Tumbleweed Connection. What are your favorite Elton stuff?
I mean,
stuff?
Tumbleweed.
Yes, brilliant.
All the early. I mean, that's probably favorite.
Yeah.
My favorite record of his, and then all the early stuff, especially. I mean, I was just a freak for him when I was 12, 13. 14. I just tried to play just like him and learned a bunch of his songs. And he was a huge inspiration early on.
It's pretty evident in a lot of your work. You can see, you know, your playing is very inspired by him. So it's very nice to hear you say that.
I'm glad to hear you say that. A lot of people say Billy Joel, which is, I love Billy Joel, but I didn't go on quite the deep dive with Billy, even though like a bunch of his songs are absolutely gorgeous.
Right.
Just something about Elton, just like the way he played and dug in and sang. It was just really vulnerable and beautiful.
Have you heard of that cover band, the early Elton Trio? There's a tribute band based out of New York by some of the guys that are in the Beatles tribute band, the Fab Four.
The Fab Four. Yeah.
Two guys from the Fab Four are members of the early Elton Trio, and they play is like early Elton stuff.
Oh, I have to check those guys out.
Yeah.
Is Will Lee in that one?
Will Lee is not in that. The drummer, Rich Pagano from the Fab Four, he's in the early Elton Trio, and one other guy from the Fab, I forget who his name is, but it's not Will, but search them up. I saw them one day. They're phenomenal. They do all the early Elton stuff. And I think somebody who really loves Elton's early, you would love those guys.
Cool. I'll check them out.
Cool.
I got to say, when I first saw, when I was doing research on you, and I saw that you were associated with Eddie Kramer, my jaw just dropped. Because I mean, he's such a legendary figure. I mean, his catalog is just, you know, goes back years and years and years. How did the working with him happened?
Oh, Eddie came by. He was doing a tour of colleges, I guess.
Okay.
Go and do a music engineering clinic. And sort of for all the like music engineering students.
Okay.
And he had kind of a contest when he came to Miami, and you could submit your band or whatever and the winner got to record with him, and like he would be like an excuse for him to show his music engineering, mic placement chops and stuff like that. So we got second place, and I think it's so I just like found him in the hallway and was like, hey, I'm Gabe, you know, here's my CD. And he, we actually got second place, and I think it's because we didn't have a guitar player, because he needed the guitar. He wanted to show how to mic a guitar to all the students and everything. But he loved us so much, he flew down after he finished that trip. He flew down, you know, paid for the trip himself, and recorded a whole album with me and my band.
Oh, wow.
At the studio, and mixed it at, at, you know, what is it, Criteria or the Hit Factory or whatever down there. And that was incredible. It was like 5 days just recording, mostly live, all to tape. And from that, we sort of got our deal with Warner Brothers eventually to get to make the record you just held up earlier.
Yeah, I was going to show that right here.
Yeah, there's a couple tracks on there that actually
he
engineered and produced.
Yeah, I was definitely going to be bringing that up here soon, because was this before you guys went to, obviously this is got before you guys went to New York then, right?
That one, we made that record actually.
I'm out of place here. So don't worry. I'm sorry.
Come on, honey.
I'm out of place right now. But this was the one. This is the album you did after working with McCartney, actually.
Yeah, we were. So here's the timeline. We recorded this album called More Than It Would Seem with Eddie down in Miami. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
A couple of tracks from that. That's my independent record. And a couple of tracks from that ended up on that Warner Brothers record. But after working with Eddie, we moved up to New York, recorded a little bit more with him, and then got a management deal and like got signed to Warner Brothers and and met David Kahn.
So we make David Kahn. Okay.
And he was head of A&R at Warner Brothers at the time. So he signed us to Warner, and we, and said, I'll be your producer. And we recorded that album called On a Rolling Ball in January of 2001. And he told us he was recording Paul's record the next month in the same studio. You know?
Awesome. Awesome. So
I was like, well, that's cool, man. Wouldn't it be cool to meet Paul McCartney? Or, you know, there's no way it's going to happen because we're recording in separate months. But in the middle of that recording session, I think I went in to play a Hammond B3 overdub on my band's album. And he came back in. He was like, hey, man, you know, you're really good. What do you want? You want to play on the Paul record? Like, well, yeah, I mean, yeah, I'll play on a track or whatever. He's like, no, I mean, we've got like, you know, guitar, drums. Paul's going to play bass mostly. Like, we don't really have a keyboard player guy, and you sing. So it'd be great to have you in the band on this record. And I said, yeah, hell yeah, man. I'm there.
Right, because he hadn't worked with David Kahn or Paul himself. He hadn't worked with David Kahn either. So I was just curious if you knew prior to that he was looking for a band to perform on this album, or you know what I'm saying. And then from there, you're recording that album in the same studio with him. So let's talk about meeting him. I mean, and your initial impressions of him then.
I mean, my initial impression, I mean, the whole thing was just surreal to me because of the massive fandom I have for him. And, you know, not just I love the Beatles stuff, but I had his like all the best McCartney collection that I just wore out, you know, in high school and college.
Right.
And when I met him, he was kind of walking in. I think he was wearing pajama pants and a T-shirt and had like one of those little like backpacker guitars on. He was just walking in. Right. Like, hey, man, you know, what's your name? David introduced me. This is Gabe. And he said, oh, Gabriel. I always liked that name, you know. And I said, it's good of my mom, you know.
Right.
Yeah. Like, you have to understand, like, I'm coming from a place. My mother was one of those teenagers who was obsessed. Like, she wanted to marry Paul McCartney when she was 3 years old. Like, she told me she got thrown out of the movie theater at a Hard Day's Night movie. Because she was screaming too loud.
Wow.
So, like, this is my universe. Is, like, Paul is, like, mythic and, like, another... He's, like, a cartoon character to me. So,
right.
When I walked in, it was a little overwhelming, to be honest, right. Because I was such a big fan and all that. And just his sort of place in the culture, it was almost like meeting a cartoon character for a minute. But, he, you know... He's after 10 minutes or so, I kind of, for the first 10 minutes after meeting him, I was kind of like, right. I don't know if this is going to fly. I don't know if I can do this.
This self-doubt starts to sink in a little bit, huh?
Yeah, it was too intense. But, you know, he's just, I think he's just used to that. I think he's just kind of like, I mean, I wasn't like freaking out over him or anything, but he's, I think since he was young, he's had people flipping out. And
of course,
I think he's so down to earth somehow. And also he's just good at sort of putting people at ease.
Yeah, he's right.
Because he has had to.
Yeah. You know? Gabe, was the rest of the band formed by the time you met him, or that was still a fluid process still happening?
David had the band and the other guys, Rusty and Abe.
Abe.
Yeah. In place. David was just kind of looking for somebody to fill in on keys that Paul wasn't playing. David really wanted Paul to play, to track on bass.
Right. You
know? And I think Paul was sort of kind of keen on the idea too.
Right.
So, so that's kind of how that happened.
How did your other band members take this? I mean, I was just kind of delayed the release of this, of that album then, correct? Kind of slowed that process down a little bit.
Well, I mean, other things slowed that process down. It didn't really delay that album. There was some sort of shifting in Warner Brothers at that time, and you know, by the time I was playing that, I played the concert for New York City with Paul later that year.
Yep.
And David was not sure if he was going to stay at Warner Brothers. Because the new president kind of wanted to be head of A&R and that kind of thing. So that delayed things. But, you know, we still had their support, like their sort of financial support. And they, you know, the president, you know, he really wanted us to stay on the label and he wanted to work with us.
Okay, so, cool.
You know, that was kind of, They strung us along a little bit, but where it counted, they were helping us out with tour support and that sort of thing.
So it was such a different world back then too, because the MP3 age was just starting to dawn. So the record industry at that time was probably the last gasp of what it used to be, you know, before, you know, MP3s and Napster really kind of just changed the whole game, you know? So that was probably the last stranglehold that the record companies had, pardon the pun.
That's exactly right.
You know,
I remember having a meeting with Tom Wally, who was the president of Warner Brothers, and he was debating. He was like, I don't know, should I put these? He was debating putting these warning labels on every Warner Brothers CD,
saying
piracy, do not steal this. You know,
right.
He was like, you think I should do that? I was like, I don't know, man. I'm not qualified. I have no idea.
That's funny. Then the band System of Down put out an EP that called Steal This Record.
It was a weird time. You're totally right. It was just, but it was good in a way for us because they were still investing like massive amounts of money in bands that no one had heard of.
Right. Which, you know, that's never ever going to happen again now.
Right. And then, hearing some stat like bands or big major labels only make money on 2-3% of the artists that they sign.
Wow.
And the rest are just, you know, throw them against the wall and that kind of thing.
See if they stick kind of thing. And then that's why touring and live performing is your bread and butter.
Yeah. So there did come a point at, you know, I mean, for me, I loved playing in my band and, there was a moment I remember coming back to New York where we were living after I finished because we did 3 weeks in February with Paul and then another 3 weeks in June with Paul. And I remember coming back after the first one, and the band was kind of like, what's going on? Are you still, is this still a band? And, you know, it was kind of like, hey guys, give everybody hugs. And I was like, try to let them know this is still, you know, Gabe Dixon Band's still right. happening. And this is just a really great gig for me. And I'm really excited right. to do this thing. And so, you know, you were asking about delaying the record. And I mean, I think if I had chosen to go all in and just stop, end my deal with Warner's and like just be a part of Paul's band on tour for the next couple of years, I think the record would have never come out, you know? Right.
Gotcha.
Delayed indefinitely on the shelf. Right.
Well, it's just curious because, you know, some of the band members have, his current band members have put out, you know, whether, you know, albums or singles as well. So I didn't know mm-hmm. if that opportunity would have been there for you if you did decide to, you know, but we can get yeah. to that, you know, a little later down the line, but I'm curious to you're there now, you're in the studio and these songs are presented to you one at a time. Paul is bringing them in saying, let's try this. Let's try that. You know, how did that process work?
He would have these at the time people used DAT tapes, you know, mm-hmm. so he would have these DAT tapes. Yep.
Okay.
He would kind of assemble upstairs and put together of just songs he had written or song ideas that he had that, you know, sometimes two or three. There's one song called From a Lover to a Friend.
Yes. Yeah.
He had three different ideas for that one. The first one was literally just a voice recorder that he used after he'd come back from a party and he'd had some wine and he like recorded this little, you know, from a lover to a friend.
Right.
Love again. It was just right. that much. And he said, so there's that. And then here's another part. And then he played us another part. So we kind of pieced it together. And literally we would sit there and listen to his ideas and write out charts, each of us.
Right.
And there would be minimal discussion about what to play. Usually Paul would play bass. Occasionally he would play one song he played track drums on.
Right.
Another song he played guitar on and Rusty played bass.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very, very kind of easy and fluid. And he said, you know, I would kind of ask Paul, what should I play on this? And be like, what do you think? You know? And
oh, okay. So you had a little bit of a freedom then.
There was definitely some freedom. And I deferred to David a lot too, because he was the producer and mm-hmm. He would give ideas. And if I had a strong, you know, preference, I'd bring it up, but otherwise I'd just kind of try stuff, you know. So well, yeah. Why don't we start? If Paul's playing piano on this, I'll play B3, you know.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And
that's another cool thing about this too, is like you play multiple different keys on this album, whether it's like Hammond, the electric piano. I mean, so many different keys. I mean, did you get your pick of what you wanted to use for that song, or was it suggested to you?
Sometimes it was suggested. Oftentimes I would just say maybe this, and they would say, right. yeah, okay, cool. Let's try it.
Okay.
That's sort of, I think most of the time I would have the idea of what to play, and then I would do it. Or they'd say, well, actually, maybe I was thinking this, you know, Wurlitzer on this one.
Yeah. Right.
B3 has such a nice warm sound though, doesn't it? It's just,
yeah,
you know, it comes across nice on this record. The Hammond B3 is nothing like that. Yeah. You're hearing that.
I bought a B3 when I was 15 and I just played it for like 4 years straight throughout high school, took it to college. So I was pretty wedded to it. Like I can express myself on the B3. And so it's fun to play, you know, and there's nothing like the sound of the tone wheels and the Leslie and everything. So there's a song called Loving Flame yep. where he played the piano and then I played B3 and that
underneath was, it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It was a great, it was a pretty important, it felt like a transitional time for him, you know, because it was the first album he did after right. Linda died,
right.
you know, and, I remember he had her camera, that he was like around the studio taking pictures of people with her camera. And I think that's sort of the symbolism is strong with the album cover, like the original album cover where he had this watch phone.
Yeah. Yep.
That one. He had this watch phone that he was running around talking about. Watch camera.
Watch camera. Yeah, little, right. Like kind of like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it would take these like super pixelated.
Which 20 years ago was like revolutionary technology. Now, you know, your Apple Watch.
Totally. Yeah. But I think the fact that all the pictures are all pixelated and grainy I think he was making a little statement about the fact that Linda's no longer around.
Right.
You know,
good take on that. That was kind of cool.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about, you know, just his demeanor or, you know, how he was in the studio, because like you said, I mean, losing Linda and then, you know, he's now in a new relationship at the time,
yeah,
you know, was it a pleasure working with him at the time, you know, at that
point? It was a pleasure. Oh, it was such a great pleasure. I mean, he was just everything that you would hope he would be as a person. He was just like super kind and down to earth and genuine and charming and like hilarious, you know, and just so talented. And I think he was kind of in love at that point with Heather, who he was dating at the time. She would come in the studio most days and was just kind of there toward the end of most days. And you know, he was kind of smitten, I think, with her.
Right.
And they were way into each other, and you can probably hear a couple of, I mean, that's what a lot of the songs on that record are about, just kind of him like reconciling, how do I love this new person and still honor, you know, Linda,
exactly,
that sort of thing. So, but yeah. No, I mean, I just had such a great time, and it almost felt normal by about 4 or 5 weeks in. You know, I remember lying on the floor in the studio while Paul was talking through something, or I'd already done the track and they were talking about an overdub or something, and I was like, this is you know, this feels kind of normal now, like,
right.
Even though it's Paul McCartney, you know.
Yeah, I mean, some of the standout tracks for me, I with your performance, I mean, there's several, but you know, there's you know, Tiny Bubbles, where you're just going, you're having a great time, it sounds like, on the Hammond organ, and yeah, I love that performance from you on that album. But my favorite of your performance on that album is Riding Into Jaipur, with, you know, just playing the piano bit, and then, you know, you're so clear throughout the whole song. You know, what are some of the standout tracks for that you did on that album for yourself?
I mean, that's probably my favorite one, Riding Through Jaipur, just because I really got to play these flurries of piano notes, you know? And you know, that was one where I just got to kind of do whatever I wanted and just accent this song. And then there was one point at which he said, he was like, on this last chorus, could you play this specific little thing? You know, I can't remember I think it was like, he just wanted a harmony.
Right.
He just wanted me to play that. And I'm like,
of course,
something simple and like, you know, immediate and direct. And I was like, yeah, of course, please. Yeah. The more guidance, the better, Paul McCartney.
Right. There's also the killer 10-minute track that what was supposed to close the album, Rinse the Raindrops, too. I mean, that was like a spur of the moment, kind of like an improvised
jam.
That was a long jam.
We must have jammed for at least, felt like 40 minutes or something, like 40 or 45 minutes. Just, we're just playing.
Yeah.
And they edited it down to whatever it is.
10, like, something.
10 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, we were just going for it. Like, it was it was so much fun.
Yeah. He's got one of the most incredible screams at the end of that track where he's just going, you know, it's just amazing. Yeah.
His voice sounds great, man.
Yeah, right. There's another track that I think probably in the second sessions and like in June, I think you said it was June that you guys went back to
February and June, basically.
In June, right?
Yeah.
Are you familiar with the song Vanilla Sky, and did you work on that one?
I don't remember Vanilla Sky being on that record.
Wasn't on the album, but he did it for the movie Vanilla Sky. But I think it was done during that second session, that June sessions. And I'm trying to know if you were familiar with that or not.
I remember hearing that song. I don't remember playing on it. I don't remember a song called Vanilla Sky. I probably would remember it.
Okay. He played it on the Oscars, right? He played it.
Yeah,
on the Oscars.
He played it on the Oscars. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Gotcha. Forgot it was during the same time as this. Forgot about that.
Right.
It's a longer McCartney record. You know, this is, yeah,
it's like 60 minutes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You don't see that. I mean, obviously, Rinse the Raindrops is 10, but,
right.
You know, it's one of his longer ones. And I think that's sometimes that it's drawn a little bit of criticism over the last 20 years of saying, he's done so many other greater albums and that one's kind of long. But, you know, I was talking to Tom about this. Like, it was such an important time because it was like, as you had mentioned, Linda had just passed away. Mm-hmm. New band, new album. We were just like super psyched for a new album. You know, what's it going to be like? You know, so, you know, then 9/11 happens. So, and then George died a few months later. So it was so much going on at this time.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. 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 I mean, I certainly didn't have anything to do with the length. And like David, I think it's funny because my record was also super long. It was like 14 songs, longest one I've ever done. Mm. The one we did right before that, and I don't know why that is. I can say that there were a couple tracks that we cut out, and one of them I really liked. It was called like "Took a Train from Washington" or something, and I remember telling him, I remember telling. Like it had the same changes as "You Won't See Me," the Beatles song.
Yeah, yep. Yeah.
And I remember noticing that as we were listening down, but I thought it was cool. I thought that was like a really cool thing about it. Right. And I mentioned it to him. I was like, "Oh, this is like the same changes as, you know, You Won't See Me." And he's like, and then it didn't end up on the record. Wow. I hope it wasn't my fault because I thought it was great.
Yeah, yeah.
But so that would have made it extra long, you know?
Right, right. At that point while you're recording, was there any talk of him wanting to get back out on the road?
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't a lot of talk about it, but it was sort of thrown out there.
Okay.
And
was that about the time you were asked?
When we were in New York, he mentioned it several times. We were at the concert for New York City.
Right.
And he said, you know, I might... you know, want to do some touring, you know, it'd be fun to have you out, you know, that kind of thing. I was like, wow, well, that'd be amazing, you know, and just before I was able to really think it through and, you know, of course, I mean, freaking Paul, it's just, it was a blast. So,
what about the whole concert for New York City thing? I mean, getting to finding out about it and then, you know, get preparing for it. I mean, were you with Paul? Were you in New York at the time? Were you home?
I was living in New York at the time. I was touring with my band that year. Mm-hmm. We were supposed to be playing on like the side stage at the Aerosmith concert in Virginia Beach, I think, that Friday. And we were just woke up one morning and got, you know, saw the news and everything and just what, you know, in a daze kind of, and had to cancel those shows. And got a call, you know, my stuff was, I was living in New York. I think I had just moved out of my apartment in Brooklyn and my stuff was in Manhattan mini storage downtown. So I was,
what part of Brooklyn, Gabe? Cause I'm an original Brooklynite. What part of Brooklyn did you?
Oh, I was in Bushwick.
Okay.
And this was 2000 and 2001 in Bushwick. Yeah, it was great. It was, you know,
Park Slope guy right here.
Okay, Park Slope, much nicer, than where we were living. Let me tell you, I love Park Slope.
Oh yeah, yeah.
No, the Bushwick. I actually got my car stolen a month after I moved there, and then 3 weeks later.
Wow. Hi,
no,
neighbor.
First I had a bunch of gear stolen on my car, and then I had my whole car stolen.
Oh, jeez.
Which wasn't so bad because I didn't really – it was kind of a hassle having a car there. So.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, yeah. It is.
Yeah, I lived in Chicago for 10 years, and you just don't need a vehicle. You don't.
Yeah. No.
Yeah. You can't park on this side of the street on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 8:30 to 11, and no days.
Yeah.
God.
Yeah, so after you've, like, stayed up till 2 a.m. partying, you got to, like, get up at 7:30.
And move your car.
Move your van across the street, hopefully.
Oh, man. Oh, that's funny. You were in New York at the time.
Yeah. My lease was up that August, and I'm just had moved my things into lower Manhattan.
Right.
Mini storage. So I wasn't even sure if my stuff was still there when the 9/11 happened. And so, it was, and I got a call from David, the producer, or Paul's management, a week or a couple weeks after that, at least, saying, hey, Paul's trying to put together this benefit, and would you want to do this? So I said, of course. Yeah. So that ended up being one of two live performances I did with him.
Right. Can you talk a little bit about, you don't have to get specific, but I'm just curious when, like, you're working on your own album, get asked to work on another album. Are you getting paid by the studio? I mean, is this a different, whole different kind of payday for you? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, definitely the Paul McCartney album, like, paid more than I'd ever made on a recording session before, you know?
Right.
David kind of set the, Paul wasn't on Warner Brothers. He was on Capitol.
Okay.
So, but David kind of put the budget together. He's like, we're going to pay all the guys this much. And it was like, great, you know, for me, it was awesome. And so it wasn't like, when it came to my band, it was just, we were just all getting kind of a stipend per month for a couple of years, which never happens now, but it was enough to walk away from that would have been like, I felt like this is the only chance I'll ever have to make like a record label giving me and my band money
to do what
be in the Gabe Dixon band. You know what I mean?
Right. Like
that's what it felt like at the time, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, when after the concert for New York, there was a point at which they called and asked me to play the Super Bowl and to do the tour.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh man, that's amazing. I definitely can do the Super Bowl.
Right.
I have to think about the tour because I'm getting tour support from the label to be in my band, and I'm
getting
a stipend, and our record's just about to come out, and we got all these tour dates booked, and whoa, let me take a day or so to think about this. And, I think it was like David, the producer, said, it was like the definition of a dilemma, you know?
Right.
Because like I win either way, you know,
sure, but
I lose either way, you know?
And morally too, you have an obligation to, you know, uphold what you want to believe in, you know? So that's very commendable. Yeah.
It was one of those weird, rare situations where I really just had to go with my gut and my heart, you know, and just like, what makes me come alive the most, you know?
Right. Sure.
Sure you wanted to make your own mark too, you know? I mean, you just didn't want to live on the coathills of McCartney.
Well, I felt like this is how I thought of it. I was like, there are probably there are more than a handful of people in this world who could do an amazing job playing keyboards with Paul McCartney, you know, like there are a lot of great keyboard players, but I just kind of was like, it felt like a responsibility that nobody can do what I am going to do. And I was 23, you know, so I was ready for an adventure, you know, I was
like,
you know, because I was like, in 10 years, would I rather look, if let's say it didn't work out with my band, like, what if I'm on tour with Paul and I'd walked away from all those opportunities?
Yeah.
You know, I think it would have been tough on my psyche.
Right.
To know that.
To not know that you didn't give it a shot. Right.
Absolutely. That's totally understandable. So. Totally understandable. Your performance that night for the concert, in the New York concert, especially during I'm Down, there's a minute you're watching it and you're going crazy and Abe's like drumming and watching you at the same time. And it's just like almost like memorized by what you're doing. I mean, let's talk about that performance. I mean, you're really on a roll there.
That was like it just felt like a mountaintop experience to me.
Right.
Just being there with all those
other musicians, my goodness. Right.
All of the musicians, just actors, politicians coming in the dressing room, and Paul was introducing us to all of them.
Right.
It was a very amazing experience. But also, I think everybody at that time kind of wanted to do something to help after 9/11. It was like, what can we, I was like, what can I do? And I felt like in a small way, I was a part of something that was helping, because we had all the fire, the first, I don't know how many rows were all just firefighters and their families.
I think most of the crowd that night had to be just about all of them. A large percentage of them were all firefighters and families. I mean, have you seen the film, The Love We Make, Gabe?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Is that the one the Maisels did?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Because I saw he was there. He was filming a bunch of stuff. And I feel kind of bad. I still haven't seen it, but I want to. I saw a couple little snippets of it, and but I need to watch that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you like it?
I did.
Yeah. It's an enjoyable show. Yeah.
But you lived it, man. So you got to see it.
Yeah,
it was fun. We rehearsed, at SIR and went through a bunch of the new songs and that was one of the first times I'd got to really play some of the Beatles stuff and Paul and it was so great. But David Bowie was rehearsing across the hall. Oh. It's just like, what's happening to me right now? We get to the concert and the Who was sound checking, with John Entwistle still playing bass.
Yeah. That's right. He's still there. Yep.
That was his last show too with them.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that was it was awesome.
I remember watching that night on VH1 and it was like a 7-hour concert. I mean, it started like at 5 o'clock at night and it went to like midnight. It was just, Howard Stern and everybody coming. It was an incredible Adam Sandler. Yeah. It was an incredible.
I mean, people were just like Bill and Hillary Clinton and Tom Daschle and Harrison Ford and Leonardo DiCaprio and Meg Ryan. Like all these people were just shuffling in and out, and James Taylor and like in and out of the dressing room. And I just kind of was like, this is
starstruck.
Yes. Yeah. Very starstruck. Yeah. But the funny thing was that they were all a little starstruck by Paul.
Yes.
Still, because it's Paul, and I'm like, I don't know. That was a kind of fun for me to see.
You see that in the video. It's like, okay, James Taylor walks in, to meet Paul, and here's James Taylor. He got to start with the Beatles, his first album was on Apple, and he still looks starstruck, 50 years later, or 40, however it was.
Absolutely.
I
think the most memorable musical moment, I think, was being on stage and we were playing Let It Be.
Mm-hmm.
And so Paul was playing piano and I was playing the Wurlitzer and Billy Joel was right next to me playing the organ.
Right.
And Eric Clapton was playing guitar, and Sheryl Crow was singing. It was just, it was a beautiful moment, and I remember, Paul was emotional about it. We got together and said a little like prayer before our set, and he was just like, if I can't get through yesterday, just, you guys just jump in and start singing, because it's going to probably be pretty emotional for me up there. Yeah. So he made it.
He made it. Yeah, he did. Yeah. He did. I mean, how long did it take for you for that high to come down for you? I mean, what an amazing night had to been for you.
A long time, I guess. Yeah. I don't know. The cool thing too was that my parents got to come and see it.
Oh, man, that must have been great.
Great.
They got to come backstage and meet him and everything. And
was your mom screaming? Did she have to get kicked out because she was screaming?
Kept it together, thankfully. I had a little talk with her before.
Right. That's funny. That's funny. What was your last question kind of on the Paul subject here is, what did you think about the album as a whole?
I mean, I loved it right after it came out. I think it stands, you know, on its, it's not like any of his other albums. It definitely feels like a band. It definitely feels like a bunch of guys just kind of jamming in the studio. Mm-hmm. I like it, you know. I like the sort of creativity of it. I like how it sort of has different textures. But it is, I was excited about it, about recording it, because he was going to play so much bass, track so much bass on it, you know? Right. So I like hearing him play that much bass. I mean,
well,
I don't know.
That was during the, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but during the reviews for the album, one of the highlights in the reviews was his bass playing. I mean, he got a lot of good reviews for his bass playing for that record. So absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. One final question on McCartney related. Gabe, you said that was one of two gigs you played live with Paul McCartney. The second one was,
the concert for New York was the second one. And the first one we did in June of
that
year. We were making the record. It was a benefit for Adopt a Minefield, which was a charity his girlfriend Heather was really into. Mm-hmm. So we did that at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel. And that was really exciting because Paul Simon was also on the bill.
Oh, wow.
So, and I'm a longtime Paul Simon fan, you know, just the from since I was a kid. And so Paul got up and sat in with us, and we did I've Just Seen a Face with the two of them singing harmony.
Oh, man. You know.
And it was great.
Wow.
Just to say.
And that was in June of that year, Gabe?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Amazing. And then you did do the Super Bowl.
You know, they said, I ended up getting back to them and saying, I'd love to do the Super Bowl, but I can't commit to the tour for 2 years or whatever. And and so they said, well, unfortunately, we need somebody who can do the Super Bowl and the tour.
Okay.
So that was sort of the last thing I did with them.
Gotcha.
So I watched the Super Bowl and I saw Wicks up there, and I was like, I remember him talking about his guy Wicks, who he'd played with a bunch before.
So. Yep. Yeah. The two prior tours, 89 and then 93. Yeah. So, okay. So let's get back to Gabe Dixon Band. You know, the lead up to, 2002, and the album's finally out.
Yeah.
And you guys toured that album, I would take it then, right?
We did. We played
almost
nonstop on tour for until about until the end of 2003.
Okay.
And then basically we were at that point, we were all living in different places, and the label, we had no more tour support, and we were kind of like, what happens now? You know?
Right.
And so we had kind of a break of at least a year or so, where I was trying to figure out what to do. And then we ended up doing this Live at World Cafe EP in Philadelphia that was sort of like just us playing live, and they put it out. Warner Brothers put that record out. And fortunately, one of the songs on that album caught the ear of a music supervisor at NBC. And so it was called All Will Be Well. And so it got into the promo of a show of a Friday night, like Law and Order spinoff show. And so from that, some other people heard it, and we kind of had a little bit of life there at the label, but ultimately we decided to leave and ended up going and starting our trio and getting signed to Concord Fantasy.
Right.
And I did a record for them. It was really great. Great album that was sort of like Village Voice did it like top 10 albums of 2008. And
excellent.
Just kind of, we toured a bunch on that and had a lot of good times. And after we'd been a band for about 10 years mm-hmm. in 2009, and I just kind of said, you know what? I think I know I'm going to keep playing my own music, but our bass player had left to go play in a band with his wife. And my wife had just gotten pregnant. And I was like, I think I'm going to just take another turn here and maybe do a solo record. And I'm not sure what I'm going to do now. So continued with Concord and put out another album and toured a bunch and then left them. And I put out my first independent release in 2016. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I just keep sort of releasing albums. And what happened to me in 2013 was I decided I needed to figure out how to be home more. So I finally did like a publishing thing where I just started, you know, being in Nashville, this is a thing a lot of people do. They'll get a publishing deal and they'll just write every day of the week with a different person.
Gotcha.
So I did that. And that was a really great way for me to write songs that could get placed in TV and film and even with some artists and that sort of thing. And it really kind of got my chops up on writing.
Right.
And so, yeah. And here,
it's
and
a good
and
way then, to stay at home, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Like I just was not into the being a delinquent father thing.
Right. Understandable. Understandable.
Gabe, tell us about the Supertramp experience.
So I was playing with my band. I also played with Loggins and Messina in 2005, and then again in 2009. And in the 2009 tour, I played in Loggins and Messina, and then I also opened the show. So my drummer and I, Jono Ricks, who plays in the Wood Brothers now. Yeah. So Jono and I opened the shows in 2009 for Loggins and Messina, and Jesse Siebenberg, who is Bob Siebenberg's son,
yes,
and a producer he's produced some of Kenny Loggins' stuff, and he's produced some really great stuff since then. And he saw me at the Greek Theater opening for Loggins and Messina, and Supertramp just happened to be looking for somebody to do some singing, mostly singing, and a little bit of auxiliary, because they have a lot of keyboard players in that band. But somebody to do auxiliary keyboards and some singing and a little percussion.
Okay.
And he asked me if I wanted to do their European tour that year. And so I did, and it was great. It was a 2-month tour all throughout Europe. It really got to get familiar with their music beyond just the hits. They're a fantastic band, and we toured in style and played arenas, and it was fantastic.
Wow.
Lots of fun.
Obviously COVID just ruined your plans last year for the most part. What are you hearing now? Cause I'm hearing, you know, live. I was a tour caterer. I'm a chef. I cater lots of hundreds of shows and stuff like
that. Oh, cool.
So I hear a lot of the insights and stuff like that from stuff. And I'm hearing that, you know, in the future, Live Nation is going to want to see proof of vaccination before the show. I mean, I'm just hearing so many different crazy things. I mean,
I
understand that, but I'm saying, what are you hearing about, you know, the return of concerts?
I'm hearing a lot of people are very hopeful, but cautiously optimistic. You know, I've heard that the realistic thing is this fall,
right?
But I'm hoping for sooner because I'm going to be going out. This past year I was supposed to be opening for Tedeschi Trucks Band and playing in their band, and with St. Paul and the Broken Bones on the bill. And all the dates got moved to this summer. So they're still acting as if that's going to happen. And nobody knows. Nobody has given me any secret information, but they haven't canceled any shows. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody's just kind of hoping that between the vaccine rollout and the weather getting warmer and people inside more, the more promising thing for us with this tour is that all of those dates are outside,
right?
Which could help. But I kind of feel like the next couple of months or maybe the next 3 months are going to tell a lot of the story. What's going to go down?
What's going to happen?
I really hope it comes back. You know, everybody.
Yeah, well, everybody does. You know, I love concert. I mean, Andy. We're both diehard concert fans for sure. Talk about the experience then. Now, when you go solo, and you're bringing a new band. Talk about that whole experience. Besides having your band, and then now you know bringing in a whole new band to do your songs. Talk about the differences between the two.
It depends. I mean, I went from like having this, like literally a business partnership with these three guys, Jono and Winston, to just kind of breaking that up and like hiring different people for every show. Really. I mean, the good thing for me was I didn't ever have to cancel a gig because one of the band members couldn't make it. You know, I could always like find somebody else, you know?
Right.
So that was part of it that made it actually easier for me. Okay. But I did want to always try to get the guys that I liked the way they played together more often than not, because there's a lot to be said for that chemistry.
Sure.
Yeah.
That just especially between the, you know, with me kind of leading the rhythm on piano, the drums, bass and piano together are just so the chemistry is really important. And so a lot of times I'll get Jono, who I was in the band with before, to play, you know, but there are other drummers. There's a guy, like I have kind of like my Northeast band that I've played with for the last few years. And this is my buddy, Randy, who I also went to college with, and a friend, Dan, who lives in the Bronx. And they, you know, they've been kind of the guys I play with in New York and all throughout the Northeast. And that they'll be my band on tour when I go out opening for TTB.
Cool. Oh man, that's awesome.
Very cool.
So, you know, it's just kind of, I mean, it's just a different thing. And I think the one thing I ended up doing a lot of solo touring, like just by myself without a band.
Oh, wow.
In 2012 and 13 and even since, you know, and I feel really fortunate that I can go out and like fill up the space and like make it cool just by myself. But I definitely miss the camaraderie, just the like bands. Feeling like I'm in a gang, you know, like, like with us taking on the world instead of me like going back to my hotel room by myself after the show. But, you know, I think that's part of why I've loved being in Tedeschi Trucks band so much the last couple of years, is just that, you know, it's a band, even though it's not like, I'm not like the lead singer or anything. It's still just great to be in a band that where I've, you know, I feel like I'm a member of the band. And so the same when I'm touring with Randy and Dan.
Right. You know. And then you still also had the time to do your own thing. Like last year, in October, you released a single, Bend the Curve.
Yeah, exactly.
Which I think was a great song. Talk about that for a minute.
Thank you. That was one. I mean, I released, I think, three songs in the second half of last year.
Right.
Bend the Curve, you know, Smoke Clears was the first one. And Bend the Curve, both of those songs were kind of me trying to smush everything that was happening last year into a song, you know, the whole, like the COVID thing and trying to get the numbers down and like racial justice awakening. And like, for me, Bend the Curve is also really about the environment and trying to protect our planet because it's, you know, our life, you know, and that's sort of what's that song was about. And it started with just me on a guitar. One of the few, I think it's maybe the only song I've ever released where I played guitar. So I played the guitar and sang and put a little bass drum thing. And I called up my buddy Dustin, who produced my most recent record that's going to come out this year.
Okay.
And said, hey, you want to throw some drums on here and bass and like make this sound like a song that's presentable? So just me and him kind of found the studio and finished it out. You know, Dustin's a phenomenal player and we have a really good chemistry. I'm about to release a couple of videos of me and him playing as a duo that are
really
pretty,
cool,
pretty great.
You know, I mean, watch some of your videos too, and just I just love watching you play piano. Just watch, you know, one of my favorite performances of yours was the Craig Ferguson show. I mean, it was just a really fun performance, playful performance from you, and really dug it. Well, you mentioned the new album. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, it's called Lay It On Me. It's not out yet, but it'll be coming out this probably late spring,
okay,
early summer. And I recorded it. I was supposed to release it this past year because it was done, but I decided to hold off. And it's really just me and the producer played almost all the instruments.
Okay.
And it's songs that it's a pretty uplifting album. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of introspective piano type things like
gotcha.
Do, but it's uplifting. It's up tempo, some of it. And it's a lot of fun, and I'm excited to put it out.
Yeah. Were these three songs that you released last year, they're going to be part of the album as well, or is that something separate?
They will not. Those were just, okay. I just wanted to put something out. So
gotcha.
I did.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I like releasing the single songs every once in a while. Like sometimes I'll get a song, for example, in a TV show and right. say, well, it'd be nice if people could listen to it if they wanted to. So I'll release it, you know, or other times I just, you know, I'm like, I'm feeling this song. So I want to put it out in the world, you know?
Right. I like getting the perspective of younger musicians because, you know, just the state of the business today, how different it is, because like in the 60s, you would see, okay, some acts would put out two albums a year. Then the 70s, you would see acts put out an album a year. Then the 80s, they would put out an album every other year. And then it just seemed like it was like, you know, farther and farther between albums. Do you think you could put out an album a year if you wanted to?
I could. I wouldn't want to because I don't... I mean, aside from just the whole like logistics of releasing it and promoting it, I think I want to make sure that every song is great.
Right.
You know, I want to make sure that it like feels like a body of work and isn't just a bunch of stuff thrown together. And I want to, you know, I have been writing a lot of songs, and not all of them are like album worthy.
Right.
Some of them are just, I got teamed up with somebody to write and, you know, it's a cool song, but it doesn't like sound like me, you know?
Gotcha. Okay. Maybe
it sounds more like
right.
them or, and so there aren't, you know, I feel like my ideas that end up on albums, they feel weird to me. They feel like weird ideas, even though I don't think they are, they're just not something I would bring into any old co-write. So,
gotcha.
I've already got, maybe almost half the next record written.
Oh, really cool.
So
very cool.
We'll see how that
gotcha.
Goes.
Well, I mean, obviously we've all got more time on our hands a little bit, I guess.
A little
That's
bit.
True.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Right. So unfortunately, you know, so plans to tour for that album are probably on hold then. I mean, was this something that you would want to do, you know, tour for that record as well?
I was going to release it and tour with it last year, but I just feel like releasing the album without being able to tour would have been not a great decision. You know, I just want the most people to hear it that can, you know. So that said, I think I'm just going to release it this year, no matter what.
Okay. No matter what, just get it out there.
Yeah.
I mean, now, yeah.
Well, I mean, are we looking at just streaming only? We're looking at CD release, vinyl release, maybe?
This will be vinyl and... I guess CD.
Okay.
Yeah, I hadn't thought too much about it, but certainly vinyl and digital release, probably some CDs.
Right.
I don't know. I got to ask around about what the best thing to do.
A lot of cars aren't being made with CD players anymore. So.
Yeah. I mean, these are the questions I have to ask about it. You know, I think I'll at least do a limited run of CDs.
Oh, yeah.
They'll exist, you know.
I still buy CDs. I still love. I mean, there's times where I'll buy vinyl and CDs of the same day with a new act. Like last time I did that, I think for Margot Price's last album, you know, I got the vinyl and the CD for it.
Yeah, you know? I mean, that's the thing. I mean, just the physical media.
Exactly.
I'm surprised at how many CDs I still sell when I play live.
Okay. Wow.
People will buy them. And I think sometimes they just want a souvenir that isn't as big as a vinyl, you know,
to carry around.
Yeah. It's kind of awkward. Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, I'll do that.
Very cool. Well, we're looking forward to new album. Hopefully, you know, let us know when it out. We can, you know, help push it and let people make sure more people are aware of the album as well. So
thank you.
We look forward to it. So thank you for this. I mean, is there anything else you want to plug? Anything else you're doing or just the new album?
Just the new album is coming out. We'll probably release the first song from it in April.
Okay.
And then maybe another one late May. And then, I think it'll be late spring when the album comes out sometime. Okay. So
excellent.
Yeah. Great. Thanks for having me, guys. This is fun. No.
Absolutely.
Thanks for coming on. And it's been a pleasure getting to ask you a couple questions and keeping it real here.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. So, all right. Before we take off, Andy, anything you want to add before we sign off?
Keep those comments coming, positive or negative, on YouTube. Thank you very much for those. And our fans are subscribing on there. And if you don't subscribe to us on YouTube, please do. Our channel is growing by the week with our content. So thank you out there, everybody who supports us.
Yep. And you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Two Legs Podcast. You can email us at twolegspodcast@gmail.com. As Andy said, please check out our YouTube channel, Two Legs, a Paul McCartney Podcast. When this episode is posted, the following week we'll be continuing our ranking the track series with the album Tug of War. Really looking forward to ranking that one. I mean, that's one of my favorite McCartney records. I wonder how different we're going to be on that album, you know. So we'll find out. So Gabe, thanks again for being here. Andy, you know, I'll see you Wednesday night. And everybody out there, as always, have a great day and a beautiful night. Take care.
Thanks, guys.
You've been listening to Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast, hosted by Tom Hunyadi and Andy Nichols, with musical contributions by Dylan.